Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Loopcast after a bit of our summer break. It's really great to be back, and we have a whole bunch of fantastic topics and shows lined up to bring you, so welcome back. I'm glad to be back as well. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we have Peter Singer on the show, and he's going to talk about, he has a new book coming out called Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. And for those that want to pre-order it, it's coming out starting of October, but you can reserve your copy now on Amazon. But first of all, thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast to discuss this fantastic book, Peter.
Oh, thanks for having me. And thanks for the kind words about the book.
You're welcome. It's really a fantastic read. And I mean, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of it, but for people interested in new forms of information warfare, we could call it, it's really a great read. Just in case someone doesn't know who Peter is, he is a senior fellow at New America and a security strategist. And he's also the author of numerous multiple award-winning books, including his most recent book called Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. And as I said, Like War is coming out in October. So if you find this topic interesting, please go out and get yourself one of the books. So Peter, maybe just to discuss this topic, what was your inspiration to write this book?
So with my books, I'm always drawn to issues that I think are important, but either people aren't paying enough attention to them or they're not well understood. So that's the thread that's linked, you know, whether it was the earlier work on private military companies and their rise to the issues of robotics to cybersecurity. And what Like War is about is the idea that essentially a generation back, researchers began to realize that people were starting to try to hack the new computer networks that we all depended on, and they called it cyber war. And we've spent the last generation basically kind of catching up to that, and everything from our research to building entire new organizations around the threats there, such as Cyber Command. And this spark for Like War was the idea that we were starting to see maybe its twin. Not the hacking of the networks themselves, but the hacking of the ideas and people on the networks. And they were popping up in everything from Russian operations in Ukraine to ISIS using social media, not just to arise and recruit, but having very real battlefield effect and things like the Battle of Mosul, to then seeing some of the very same tactics play out in our politics, where you were seeing elections being influenced by information warfare techniques. And so it was this everything coming together and thinking that, hold it, we didn't well understand it, and we weren't paying attention to the scope and importance of it.
So in the book, you discuss this idea of social media and the internet as a weapon, and I would love for you to elaborate on that, because as the book title is, Like War, there's this massive amount of new technology, and it's been used in so many interesting ways, especially in the last couple of years, as it's used, you've just discussed.
Well, it's not just a weapon. It's really, to pull back, it's a battle space. It's a new kind of battle space, and it's the strange thing that this battle space, you know, started as a, you know, light and airy place. One of the fun things the book does is goes back and looks at internet history. You know, we all use the internet literally every day, and yet we really don't know very well about its start. So, you know, for example, arguably the very first social network started in an email chain about science fiction, appropriately enough. And then now we use it for, you know, everything from sharing our summer vacation photos to learning the latest news. But also it's become a place that everything from politicians to extremist groups to rock stars all try and turn that sharing of information into something to win their wars, whether their wars are actual wars or their wars are marketing wars. And then you get the strange mix that people are actually winning parts of their wars through marketing or win their elections, is back and forth. And so the result is that we've got this world where attention is power, and not just power online, but the power to, for example, become a new kind of president, to become a new kind of terrorist group. You're talking about ISIS, become a new kind of rock star. And so those that understand the rules of like war have found ways to achieve real world power that previously was unimaginable.
You just mentioned the rules of like war, so why don't we discuss those a bit?
Sure. So a lot of these rules seem like contradictions, or they wouldn't have previously been possible, but they're the result of this kind of world that we've entered into. So one, for example, is the idea that secrets come now with a half-life, or arguably there's no more secrets. And what this means is that, you know, we have a change to not only is, you know, at least half the world online, but all these computers and the people behind them that are online have something that the original computers didn't have. Whether you're talking about the first two computers linked into ARPANET to the computer that Mark Zuckerberg used to create FaceMash in his dorm room, they lack sensors. They lack the ability to gather information about the world beyond the computer. And then, as Mark Zuckerberg is, you know, clearly part of the story, you have the rise of social media, where now we're not just all personal collectors of information, but we also now share out that information. And so when you have this mass scale of sensors, this mass scale of sharing, essentially it's very hard to keep anything a secret. Sometimes that sharing is deliberate. It might be the 26,000 selfies that the average millennial takes. It might be something in the background of those selfies. I was part of a project that figured out details of a Chinese aircraft carrier based on what was in the background of a photo. It might be information that's shared that's not visual, but even psychological. We have the very first president to enter office with a digital trail behind them on social media. And every future president, every future general, every future, you know, you name it, will come with this digital trail. So it's that. It might be technical information. We had CIA black sites outed by the exercise apps revealing the outline of the base's perimeter. We could go on and on, but the point is that you have this mass scale of collection and sharing that then can be mined to reveal what previously would have been secret. And it fundamentally changes everything from military operations. You can't pull off something like the D-Day invasion and, you know, keep an entire invasion site and army location secret. You know, the bin Laden raid shows that, where it's supposed to be the most secretive operation of our lifetime. And it's live tweeted by a Pakistani cafe owner who's up late at night in Abbottabad. Hears helicopters coming in and does the new natural thing. He goes online to Twitter to complain. But the point is, you may, you know, rule number one, you may have no more secrets. However, rule number two, the truth can be buried underneath a sea of lies. And again, that's the essence of whether you're talking about Russian information warfare in Ukraine, to how it spilled over into impacting everything from elections in Scandinavia, to Brexit, to the United States, to most recently the Mexican election. And that truth being buried under a sea of lies is another part of one of these contradictions, where we're all connected. We all have a voice, and yet governments have found new ways of censorship. And it might be new forms of monitoring our every thoughts and moves. To what Russia has basically done is figured out how to export censorship into another nation by spreading disinformation. There's other examples of this, of, you know, the idea of, as I mentioned, attention is power, and therefore there's rules to driving your message viral. And one of the fun things of the book is we used examples that ranged from TV reality stars to trolls to terrorists to Taylor Swift, about what are these rules to driving your message viral and winning at what you're doing. And that's, again, what's kind of strange about all of this, is that we can talk about very, you know, classic military operational issues. You know, we do deep dives into Battle of Mosul or military training exercises out at Fort Polk. But what you will see is reminiscent of what's happening in pop culture or whatnot. And it's because each of those spaces is mining each other's for lessons.
I was actually recently at a conference on terrorism and the use of new media and the internet. And that was a huge topic about how different groups are all learning from each other, and the campaigns that maybe ISIS used are now being employed by far-right groups and so forth. So why don't we discuss this a little bit about this learning curve, or you could even call it like an instruction manual. One group does something and the next group learns from that, or the next individual.
So the, it's both that, but I want to hit how it's even larger than that. You know, when ISIS arose, and there was this fascination with the idea that it had a 7th century outlook on the world, but it was using 21st century technology. And it almost became this obsession. You know, for example, people used the descriptor slick more than 5 million times to describe, you know, this mystery of how is it so slick at its propaganda and its messaging. And the reason was it was basically made up of a bunch of people who had grown up in this world. They weren't doing anything all that novel. They were creating a hashtag to launch their offensive. They were setting up bots to drive their message viral. They were sharing personal messages that were then broadcast out to the world. What they were doing is what, you know, frankly, any millennial would do. And yet on the military side, we were going, oh, my God, they're so slick. How can they do this? Why are they so much better than us? So there's it's not just the learning from group to group, which is definitely going on, but it's also just learning to adapt to the changes that social media has brought to the world. And that's where you see, you know, this first layer of learning is where you, you know, have a, be it an alt-right group or a political campaign that's looking at what Taylor Swift has done to drive her message viral or to build an online army and then applying it to their own field. But then we have the second part of what you hit is, you know, essentially people model after success. And so whether you're talking about ISIS as a model for insurgent and terrorist groups moving forward, and we've definitively seen that where other groups are learning from them, copycatting them, even their direct adversaries in the game. You know, for example, the Taliban has been consciously copying certain things that ISIS has done. So you have that kind of direct learning, but it's also happening out in politics. You know, so the tricks of the trade that Donald Trump, you know, half of it was just his own natural, he was born with a skill. The other half was underneath it. There was a very well thought out strategic campaign. It's actually a split is one of the other things to deep dive into. There's a difference between Trump on Twitter and Trump campaign on Facebook. But the bottom line is that that model is something that both political campaigns outside the United States and Trump's own adversaries are going to adopt for the next election. So it's going to continue to grow. And then we have the other part of this of why it's all going to continue to grow is that we're really just at the start of all this. You know, it's a really enormous historic deal that about half the world is online. That means about half the world is still to come. So these early days of like war, these battles playing out on our networks are only going to grow in both scale and importance as more and more people come online.
That right there to me is a very important thing to think about, because looking at how the online world and social media has influenced so much in our lives in the last handful of years, it's almost frightening to think that, as you said, half the world still is catching up. So it will be really interesting to see if that's in my lifetime, what that next phase will look like. Going back to the idea of like war, how should we think about the strategy of like war, especially looking at these different successful models that you've mentioned in the book and highlighted?
So I want to hit that one point, though, of it playing out and sort of the idea of the scary side of it. One of the concerns we should have is that we've already seen the impact of this on our own democracy and our own institutions. And again, those institutions might be anything from our media to our respect for legal institutions, national security institutions, you name it. And we have a democracy that, you know, has 200 plus years at this, has multiple centuries at this. We're feeling the force of it. Where it's hitting even more is in nations that don't have those kind of once strong institutions, and where social media really truly is the internet. So you look at, for example, what's played out in Myanmar or the Philippines is another example, where, you know, Facebook literally is the internet. It's the portal for everyone. It's not the, if you look at the use and the saturation, it's the contained space for it. And we've seen the impact of these battles, and this is to get to the other part of your question, the strategy, the idea of driving your message viral through likes and lies, and adapting your message to this battle space and the underlying algorithms that run it, that has been crucial to everything from the rise to power of leaders to fomenting genocide. And what we have to do is understand this space better and develop better responses to it. And when I say we, you know, that applies to everything from governments to the tech companies that now run these platforms that are, strangely enough, some of the most powerful actors in war and politics are actually a handful of, you know, basically tech geeks that are not all that interested in war and politics, to you and I, you know, the citizens on these platforms, the consumers of these services.
Considering like war, what would you consider a successful campaign coming from the side of someone that, whether it's a group, a political campaign, a individual, what would a successful campaign look like for them in this internet social media world?
Sadly, one of the most successful would be the Russian operations against first Ukraine and then broadening out to include the United States. You know, we have a fundamental misunderstanding of propaganda and kind of where it layers over to information warfare. We tend to think of it as trying to make you to like me. It's a very kind of American approach. The Russian approach is actually instead to use it to further divide and create distrust in institutions. And again, whether we're talking about the initial forays into Ukraine to the campaign to spread disinformation, a fog of disinformation into the 2016 election in the United States, an incredibly successful campaign, particularly when you compare it to the amount of spin that it took. I mean, it's, you know, literally a micro portion of one F-35. And yet, you know, in both situations, it altered history. So very successful campaign. And again, back to your earlier question, that's why we are seeing not just Russia continue in that campaign. And we've seen, you know, examples that run from it, you know, trying to layer on to everything from NFL protests to Charlottesville, you name it. But we've also seen other actors look at this and say, hold it, this was incredibly cheap and it worked. I could do that too. And those other actors are not just other nations, other governments, but also non-state actors. And those non-state actors range from criminal groups to, I expect we'll also see this with like high net worth individuals that are, you know, single issue, I really just care about, insert topic here, tax policy, whatever. Again, these tactics worked and therefore, like everything else, will be modeled after.
So going back to something that you mentioned just a little bit ago, you've described different tactics. There's the tactic of getting the masses to really like you or love you and your message. And then the Russian example is, you know, creating dissent among actors. And with that dissent, it ends up being misinformation and, you know, lies, et cetera, et cetera. So how can we as the public and also analysts and people within the field that are tackling this every day, how do we deal with this idea of disinformation in this new sphere and its dissemination? How can we actually trust what's out there? I know that's a big topic that's been in the news with Facebook, et cetera. So I would like to hear your side of it.
Sure. And like everything else, there is no silver bullet solution. There is no one thing. And we go pretty deep into the what can we do at the end of the book and break it down into what can government do, what can the companies do, what can we do. On the governmental side, just like we had to do with the rise of, you know, what we might jokingly think of, but truly think of as traditional cyber threats, we also have to do here with the like war side of things. And I should, as an aside, you know, the term like war is a play. It's a play on the idea of it like war, in terms of, you know, in warfare techniques playing out. But it's also a term, a like war is when you have two competing tribes online, be they, you know, fans of Kanye West versus Taylor Swift trying to drive their message viral. And again, you know, using the very same tactics that ISIS was using to win out in the early battles for Mosul. So on the governmental side, it needs to understand this as a national security issue, understand it as a strategic space, and start to develop organizations and strategies to respond. Some of these might be bringing back old organizations. During the Cold War, for example, we had something called the Active Measures Working Group. It was basically a, you know, now we would call it an interagency team that brought together everything from the intelligence community to the State Department to the media side. And essentially, they tried to identify Soviet, so KGB disinformation, active measures campaigns that were trying to plant false stories in crucial Cold War battlegrounds and identify them and develop responses to them. Back in the day, the crucial battlegrounds was what we called the Third World. And there were examples like, you know, planting false stories on, you know, U.S. military activities, to even conspiracy theories like, oh, the United States created AIDS. It was part of an effort to try and sabotage the Olympic Games. But so it identified them and then developed responses to them. We eliminated that. We need something like that now. This moves to also budget spend questions. We have the very strange phenomena that we have funded certain programs within the State Department that have not actually spent their money to deal with things like Russian disinformation. It might not just be in the State Department. It might be on other areas. We again have a very strange phenomena that the United States government has paid for Ukrainian students to learn how to identify disinformation online, but our own students are not taught that. Okay, so we could go on and on about the governmental side. Then you get the private company side. The private company side is to recognize that they have created these spaces, and they may not want to face up to it, but their creations have become not only connection points, but battlefields, and battlefields that have been used to target and abuse their customers. And that requires them to develop measures and response. And, you know, this is part of a larger debate that's going on right now. But one of the big things is to change the approach to what we think of as beta testing. Previously, they've pushed out products without considering how bad guys might use and abuse them, and or their own customers might accidentally use or abuse them in ways that are harmful. And, you know, that is fine to beta test, to push something out and learn from the customer when it's an app for like a restaurant review. It's not when it's the nervous system of not just our economy, but our politics writ large. Next issue, you and I. Part of this is learning how these platforms work that we use every single day. Well over half the people that use social media don't understand its basics. Understanding how to better handle information itself. And, you know, this is, again, not all that new. There's the, we use the idea of the blind men and the elephant. If you're only touching one part of the phenomena, you won't have the truth. The same for us. If you're only staying within one lane, if you're not checking that information, testing it against other sources of information, you're not going to have the truth. Maybe a different way of putting it is it's a little bit akin to the idea if you sit down at the poker table and you don't realize who's the mark, you're the mark.
That's a good analogy. I like that. You mentioned a word, and that is identifying. And looking at all of this and looking at campaigns that we've seen or individuals, how can governments and analysts and once again the general public, how can we separate certain accounts that potentially are country-led campaigns, non-state actors, or those occurring naturally? Of course, sometimes it's very obvious, but then there are times where there's really a gray line where maybe it seems like it's just an individual, but it's actually a country-led campaign. Are there any clues that can help us with identifying the core of what this message and where it's coming from, really?
Yeah, great question, and obviously a huge issue. And one of the more, interesting real-world characters in the book who we interviewed was a former head of an intelligence agency, the U.S. intelligence agency. And he talked about how the biggest change in his lifetime was the complete flip in the value of open source intelligence. That previously, you know, we looked for the good stuff. We looked for the gold nuggets in SIGINT and Signals Intercept and Inhuman and what spies were telling us. But that since the rise of social media, it's completely flipped. It's gone from, you know, he framed it as 90-10, that now 90% of the good stuff was out there in OSINT, in open source intelligence, and that we needed to change to understand that. And that meant we had to reorient the kind of collection and analysis, but also how we were teasing things together. And he emphasized this. And like, now this is me speaking. You can actually see this phenomena playing out and how we, in essence, missed what was going on in the efforts to sabotage the efforts to influence the 2016 election, whether it was U.S. government to the cybersecurity teams at the tech companies that we were speaking to. They were looking in the wrong place. They were looking for attempts to hack into the networks and the like, as opposed to actually it all playing out in the open. So Facebook is looking for attempts to hack customer accounts, not, hold it, what about just buying ads and pushing it out there? So this incredible value of open source intelligence means that we have to reorient. Now, you've read the book, so you know the kicker on this. That person who told us about this is General Michael Flynn, who, after he is fired as the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, has, in essence, a personal turn. And he becomes a source of massive amounts of conspiracy theory online, pushing out all sorts of conspiracy theory, everything from Obama is not just a secret Muslim, but he's a jihadi, to hashtag spirit cooking, which was, if you're not familiar with it, it was the idea that there is a secret cabal of people in D.C., D.C. elite, who have secret dinners where they consume human blood and semen. We talk about this in the book of he's exactly right. And open source intelligence is where the gold is now. but it's also where the pyrite is. It's also where the fake gold is. And it's this back and forth that's really determinative. But one of the things that we have to do in response to that is, to make a pop culture reference, be like the North from Game of Thrones. You have a history online. Don't forget it. That should follow people. When people push out conspiracy theory, be it spirit cooking or, you know, one of the other episodes we talk about is Pizzagate, that should follow people. And when they are pushing something else out, it should be remembered that they were the source of some of this craziness. And not just when it's craziness, it also might be when they are pushing out foreign government disinformation campaigns. That should follow them. It should not be forgotten. And we're really not going to be able to deal with the worst actors online until we change the incentive structures. Because, you know, again, the example of Pizzagate, I think, is a good illustration of this. Some of the people that pushed out Pizzagate have actually since been rewarded with everything from greater jobs to the ultimate reward online, multiple retweets from the most powerful voice in all of social media, the President of the United States himself. So we're not going to be able to deal with this problem until we tackle the underlying incentives behind it.
On that point, how do we do that when a president is, in a sense, promoting individuals that have been involved in things like Pizzagate? I mean, that's really hard when someone is in a position of great power. So how do we even deal with that? That's the conundrum.
You've just hit an enormous conundrum, not just for you and I, but a conundrum that's playing out within, you know, when you speak to anything from tech company executives to members of the U.S. military to diplomats wrestling with how to build international norms to lawyers, you name it. Everyone's wrestling with that question. And, you know, again, that question is something that's not just a company policy question. It's also a political question. All I can say right now is that it has to be challenged. Whenever someone, be it a president to a journalist, pushes out the voice of not just a known conspiracy theorist, but someone who has a proven track record of multiple lies, you call them out on it. And you say, you know, this is what you are doing. You are part of the problem. Are you going to continue to be knowingly part of the problem, or are you going to be part of the solution?
That is good advice. And personally, I've been doing some research on individuals involved in terrorism, and some of them are related to September 11th. And it's amazing when you type in names, the amount of crazy conspiracy theory topics on September 11th. I mean, it boggled my mind in the last couple of days, especially with the anniversary of September 11th coming up tomorrow. But yeah, it's amazing the amount of disinformation, conspiracy, whatever you want to call it, messaging campaigns, you could even call it that, looking at it from the messenger's side. But it's amazing the amount of stuff that's out there. And of course, the internet is this free entity where anyone can really create a website or post something on Twitter or Facebook. And so it's just opened up this floodgate for lots of ideas. It's a war. It's a environment of a war on ideas almost.
And there's two important spinouts from that. The first is that may seem, you know, we may describe it as crazy or whatnot, whatever the conspiracy theory is. And it might not be something as, you know, extreme as in terms of conspiracy theories as, you know, whether it's they fake 9/11 to Pizzagate. It might be just a false news about the state of the economy, whether, you know, certain economic figures are historically good or not, where they're, you know, they're definitively the fact is one way or another. But the point is, in a world where we increasingly get our information, our news online, it does become real, at least to those people who consume it. And that is an issue that's interesting because it connects not just the battle back and forth on things like Facebook or the like, but it's also part of measures of social control in other societies. One of the sections of the book looks at China and the system there of everything from web censorship to the social credit system that provides these kind of weird rewards that takes it all into a space that Orwell never could have imagined. But one of the examples is you literally don't have a means for finding out information related to Tiananmen Square, the protests in 1989. And so what that results is literally an entire generation that's not just unaware of the facts that happened, but also would not even know where or how to look for them if they even heard about it. So it's this measure of control and the like that's out there. But there's a second part of this is the importance of the algorithms underneath this. So whether you're talking about Chinese web censorship system that simply does not allow you to search for certain words or phrases, they literally just disappear off the web, to your example of 9/11 conspiracy theory, part of its potency, part of its virality is the fact that if you go searching for a fact, a high school student who wasn't alive when 9/11 happens, is told to do a book report on it, goes as they would not to an encyclopedia at the library, but goes to YouTube and hunts for it, finds a video, but then very quickly on the list of suggested ones on the side, very quickly it'll take them down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theory. And, try that out. Look at whether it's terrorist attacks to the Federal Reserve. Very quickly, the basic algorithms will start taking you down pathways that reward extremism, reward conspiracy theory, because that is what someone is more likely to click on, more likely to spend time on, more likely to argue on.
So on that topic, I want to kind of switch it to these handful of companies, the social media internet companies that, as you said earlier, have a lot of power. So the big question is, the responsibility of these companies, and are social media companies even incentivized to solve problems of misinformation and disinformation? Should we be putting restraints on them to make content disappear, like taking down content? Like, what are your thoughts on this? Because for me, it's a very tricky topic of how responsible should these companies that have platforms that are being used, what is their responsibility, basically?
Yeah, and it's a very controversial one, and it's one that's easy to get angry about when you now see and understand some of the things that played out on their networks. And you can see the companies themselves are going through almost something equivalent to the stages of grief, where, originally they were in denial that this even could have happened. Mark Zuckerberg's famous response right after the 2016 election, that it's, pretty crazy that anyone could have been influenced by something that played out online in their physical behavior. And you're like, dude, that's what your entire company is based on. That's literally the profit model of your company, advertisements that influence people to take a certain action. And of course, actually simultaneously to him saying that, there was a section in Facebook that was talking about, it was from the corporation talking about its impact on elections, that it was the best place actually to influence elections. But the point is, you have this early kind of stage of denial and then grief and then bargaining. What if we do X? What if we do Y? And now they're kind of, they're in a different place and they've come to accept it and they're doing more on it. It's a wonderful historic what if. What if some of the measures that have been put in place, not just by Facebook, but by Twitter or Reddit, Google, YouTube. And again, this is another important point, is to remember that like war moves across platforms. But basically, you know, what if some of the things that they've put into place now in 2018 had been in place in, you know, 2014, how would they have affected what ISIS was able to pull off or not? Or 2015, 2016, how would they have affected what Russia was able to pull off or not? But, you know, those are one of those fun what-ifs of history. But so basically, you know, what I'm getting at is there's a lot to be angry about. And there are definitely certain things that they can and should do. We, you know, they range from, it might be policy changes. For example, there's a disconnect when you and I are talking right now in how evidence of foreign disinformation campaigns is handled. Some platforms, once they identify it, preserve it. Reddit is an example. So they lock down the accounts, but they save it so that researchers can study it. Frankly, you know, future students in classes might go to it and say, you know, here's an example of it. It's kind of a almost like a memorial to like war. Other platforms, Facebook, basically arrive at the crime scene with a vacuum. And that means that what happened isn't preserved, and it's very difficult to study. And it's also difficult in this kind of argument back and forth. And this brings you back to your point on 9/11. Did it even happen? Who did it, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so for example, you have certain addresses, handles that were used by Russian disinformation that have recently been re-released into the wild, and now they're being used by like a softball team in Texas. So if someone, you know, reads about it and then goes and hunts for it, they're like, this is a softball team. Well, that's what it is now, but it wasn't back in 2016. So that's an example of a policy change. It might require a policy change for government to step in to encourage them. A good illustration of this is what to do about bots, what to do about machine voices online. And again, circling back to what you and I were talking about, we're at the super early stages of it. The bots that we're dealing with right now are, you know, they're like the biplanes of World War I compared to, you know, the stealth fighters of today. They're, you know, pretty easy to figure out that they're bots, and yet they are incredibly influential in steering online conversation one way or another. One third of the online conversation related to Brexit was steered by bots. Several years later, one third of the Mexican election this year steered by bots. And again, the challenge here is that bots are used by everything from clear bad guys, disinformation warriors. ICE is using it to drive their messages viral, but they're also used by digital marketing for, you know, everything to jokes and the like. So there is a policy question that's, you know, I jokingly think of it as the Blade Runner rule. Do we need to label a bot to say this is a machine? So we allow them to operate online, but we identify them so that the humans interacting with them know this is not a real human. It's a false voice. That question is one that maybe we shouldn't rely on the companies to answer for themselves, that maybe there's bigger issues at play when it comes to, you know, everything from consumer security to national security. These are just some of the illustrations that are playing out. But again, what I find so fascinating about it is that these questions are ones that are highly determinative. Again, they influence whether terrorist attacks happen or not. They influence whether groups like ISIS thrive or not. They determine the outcomes of elections or not. And yet they are decided right now by literally a handful of people who are in this role, basically because they invented a really cool technology for a fundamentally different purpose. You know, whether you're talking about Zuckerberg, who's basically starts out creating a way for his fellow classmates at Harvard to vote on whether their dorm mates are hot or not. That's the origin of FaceMash. Or if you look at Twitter, you know, it's basically a messaging device. It's almost like a what we would think of as chat right now that goes on to, you know, help determine who becomes a president or not. And so they're in these very powerful roles. And I circle back to saying, you know, we can be upset, but actually we really shouldn't be all that upset, because just like the internet itself, the people in these positions are maturing along with it. They're starting to wrestle with all of this. And, you know, that's going to be this important force moving forward.
So do you think, in your opinion, looking at examples like in the UK, where they've made restrictions on how long a group of internet and social media companies are responsible for taking down, let's say, terrorist propaganda like ISIS. And so takedown times of content that's disseminated across multiple platforms has become much quicker, especially in the last year and a half or so. And it does, in a sense, slow down the group's messaging. But do you think the essence of it really puts a stop to it with a group like ISIS or a disinformation campaign? Or is it just slowing down the process, and eventually these groups, these individuals, these states will find another way of getting the word out on the internet via social media, etc.?
So in this battle, it's important to, you know, pull back and note that originally the company said, well, that's not even our job. Anything and any message, anyone should be allowed online. We should not, will not be in the position of deciding that. And, you know, as we go back in the book and explore, there's actually a long history of them deciding that. It's just this sort of slippery slope where they keep coming up with out clauses to that, you know, and originally it was examples like abuse of children online, where everyone could agree this was bad. And most importantly, and this is the second part, it was to the company's interests to do something about it, that the early users of this platform and the law might intervene if they didn't find a way to get this stuff off their network. And so they said, it's not our role. And then, well, actually, kind of in this case, it is our role. And then related to terrorism, a good example of this was, we at one point in time, you had terrorists, you know, open use of it. You look at, for example, the takeover of the shopping center in Kenya many years back, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's hold it, okay, actually, we don't want them displaying violence online. And that starts when you have the issues of, for example, YouTube beheading videos and the like. Okay, we'll do something about that. Then you have examples of terrorist propaganda. So you have Al-Awlaki, you know, a prominent propagandist who is allowed to stay on YouTube because he's not actually showing any images of violence. He's just calling for violence. Then we change the policy and now we'll do something about it. We'll take it offline. Then we get this, well, is it just Al-Qaeda or is it terrorist groups writ large? Is it extremists writ large? And this really comes to the fore after the Charlottesville, where you have a neo-Nazi that kills a young woman. And companies that had previously said, well, you know what, it's okay for them to use our platform, as one of the CEOs and founders of a company puts it, nope, I changed my mind. And he actually at least is, you know, self-aware enough to say, I shouldn't have this power, but I do. And so I'm not going to allow them to use my platform anymore. So what I'm getting at here is that, you know, first is that there's a long history of this, but very quickly where it falls into is tough political questions that the companies have to answer. And then every single time they look to technology to try and answer these political questions for them. So this is playing out right now in direct answer to your question about, you know, sort of the taking content offline. They're looking to artificial intelligence to automate that, to do it for them. But just like everything else in war, as Clausewitz would have explained to us, even though, you know, he couldn't even conceive of the internet, there's going to be a back and forth. There's going to be a response. And so what groups do, whether it is ISIS or alt-right neo-Nazi trolls, is they figure out what is the policy, what is the mechanism, and then go just to the line of it. So if it is this kind of image that's not allowed, I'm going to tweak it to have that kind of image. If it's this particular word that's identified as not allowed, then I'll do this. And so you see a lot of kind of the veiling. And this is, you know, what's interesting about this, and again, its impact on our broader politics, is this is where internet trolls both thrive and love. It's the wink and the nod. It's the veiled reference to something that's neo-Nazi, but I didn't say anything that was neo-Nazi or, you know, white supremacist. And in fact, you're the one who's being racist by or trying to against freedom by coming after me at this. And, you know, that's a wonder, you know, it's the sort of part of internet troll culture is to try and play with that line and then attack, 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 and then play the victim. And, you know, it's funny because I think what plays out in internet troll culture is one of the best ways of understanding the broader changes in American politics today.
It seems like there's a very fine line in this whole narrative of what we would constitute free speech and then censorship, and that can be used actually to further gain support from your campaign depending on how companies and governments respond to what you're saying.
And that's, again, where the history matters. So when a group that, you know, for example, has shown no interest in women's rights and has consistently been hateful and attacking of women, then suddenly tries to claim that it's being it's defending women's rights in some way, shape, or form. We can see this, you know, sort of the very similar tactics used by alt-right to go after everything from politicians to Hollywood directors. You know, don't just take what someone says on face value. Look at their history and weigh that in. Mm. A good, you know, and again, what we look at in the book is there are different issues of speech. There's free speech and there's censorship, but there's also what's known as dangerous speech. And dangerous speech is actually, it's very interesting. It's a concept that was created by people from multiple different nations around the world. So it's not, you know, linked to one culture. It's, you know, everything from people in Kenya to India to the United States. And basically, they tried to identify what are the particular forms of speech that spur mass violence. And so, you know, it wasn't just hate speech. It wasn't just something that's a mistruth. Those happen all over the place. It was, what are the forms of speech that spur mass violence? And they basically came down and found sort of five indicators of it. And we point to that as, you know, that's another place that the companies can turn to of saying, okay, my job, you know, I'm not going to be able to police every kind of mistruth that's out there. But I can identify when these five forms come together to create dangerous speech that spurs mass violence. That I have an obligation to act on.
So to slowly bring this conversation to an end, where do you see this new type of information, disinformation, this like war going in the coming years? I mean, you touched on it earlier, but what might the future look like for us in the internet social media sphere?
I think it's, you know, it's more. As we talked about, it's more people coming online. Half the world is yet to come. more places that are covered by it. Whether you are at the top of Mount Everest to in a U.S. military nuclear missile bunker, you can access social media. At least that's the plan that Xi Jinping Command is working with. So more people online in more places and using it for more uses. This is where the model in China of the combinations that you see of everything from Amazon to Facebook to Yelp kind of all brought together into the same platform. That's something that is completely normal and familiar to someone using the internet in China. It will become familiar to us. But also more of these like war battles playing out. Again, using the lessons of how to drive your message viral through likes and maybe lies to achieve your goals. As we talked about, the lessons are out there in the open, so more people are going to copy them. These mores mean that they will also have more impact. Whether it was the Barack Obama mobilizing using the internet to Donald Trump using it organizationally and really kind of to dominate the battle against first his Republican rivals and then Hillary Clinton, it will become more and more determinative, more and more impactful. Another more is more and more automated. We're just scratching the surface of what artificial intelligence can do, including in these spaces. So you will see more of these like war battles, but more involvement of artificial intelligence battling over your and my beliefs. So just more of this. But at the end of it, it still comes down to the lesson that we end the book on. You are what you share, and what you share reveals who you truly are.
And I think that is a perfect way to end the show. It gives a lot of food for thought, just like the book. So if you as a listener are interested in this topic, the book has a lot of thought-provoking concepts and things that you read about what we've seen happening, and as we just said, you start thinking about the future. So it's a great read. I highly recommend it. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and discussing the book with us, Peter.
Oh, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.